Hear that? It's the sound of someone whacking the ground with a rake. Specifically, they're beating around the bush, which we've done enough of in this ad too, so let's get right to it. The new Moneymaker scratch-off from the Ohio Lottery doesn't beat around the bush. Moneymaker. Play the game and you could win money. Up to $2 million. With more than $88 million in prizes, ranging from $50 to $500, Moneymaker cuts right to the cash. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
At IKEA, your dream home is a blue bag away. No matter the size of your space or budget, we've got everything you need to turn your dreams into reality. And now with new lower prices on hundreds of our most popular products, bringing the dream home is even easier. Like the gray Strandom wing chair, was $369, now $299. And the IKEA Plus 365 9-piece cookware set was $129.99, now $89.99. And hundreds more. Shop new lower prices at IKEA-USA.com today.
Mother, where do you live?
Hey everyone, welcome back to the Underrated Podcast. This is a podcast where we discuss films that are underrated, underappreciated, and ones that have just slipped under the radar and passed most people by. We are the Undercast Company, made up of Ariel Ortiz, Alan Torres.
Hey, what's up everybody?
And myself, Derek McDuff. And we are joined this week by a very special guest, Alex Calleros of Beyond the Screenplay, one of my absolute favorite podcasts. So thank you so much for coming in and talking to us, man.
My pleasure. Ooh. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. And Alex chose today's movie that we're going to be talking about. It's going to be 2005 or 2006, depending on what release date you use, but the Terrence Malick film, The New World. And Alex did specify for the 135-minute version of this, so not the original kind of weird cut that came out, and not the extended cut, but just the shorter version that's still 2 hours and 15 minutes long. But Alex, why don't you go ahead and we'll let you start off the discussion, telling us why you chose this film and what you think about it.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, so starting off with the whole idea of the three cuts, I think it's a really interesting example of, I think a director like Terrence Malick, for my taste personally, is best when he's given some constraints and is kind of pressured to not be just 100% indulgent with what he wants to do, but actually both have to operate somewhat within a studio system, but still is a stubborn enough director that he's going to insist upon being himself and like will not let a movie come out unless it's still like a Terrence Malick movie. Mm-hmm. And I think The New World is underappreciated because I think it is the best melding of those two worlds, in my opinion, of his filmography, where you both have this, you know, very dramatic story about the founding of Jamestown and a kind of a fictionalized romantic historical epic about Pocahontas, whose name never comes up in the movie, but it is the character of Pocahontas. So it's on the one hand, a big studio movie. On the other hand, it's very Terrence Malick, very much a tone poem, very just romantic and gorgeous and reveling in nature. But it's not a Tree of Life. It's not a later stage Malick where he kind of gets maybe too indulgent for my tastes and leans so hard into the tone poem side of things that you can kind of just feel adrift for very long stretches of the movie without any kind of plot to hold on to. So I just think this is a movie that not a lot of people have seen. And, Tree of Life was just kind of this big deal when it came out because it had this like crazy evolution sequence and Brad Pitt. And there was a lot of buzz around Tree of Life. But this movie was made before, I think this was the one just before Tree of Life. I mean, he doesn't make movies very often. But this era, that was kind of like his return to filmmaking after a long break, which is he did The Thin Red Line and then shortly after did The New World. And this like 1-2 punch of his like return to filmmaking, doing these kind of big, big historical epics back to back, is my favorite period of Malick. So all of those reasons are why I want to talk about this movie in particular in his filmography, because I really like this moment in Malick's film career. And this movie in particular, I just find to be both gorgeous and poetic in the way that I want from a Malick film, but also very entertaining and very dramatic and has a lot of dynamics in its storyline in a way that some of his other films don't necessarily concern themselves with. Yeah, so that's kind of my reasoning for wanting to talk about The New World.
Very nice, very nice. Yeah, no, I completely agree with everything you're saying about it's definitely the Malick sweet spot where, mm-hmm. you know, you watch something like Song to Song, and that's a movie right. I appreciate, but I don't think that it's, like, great, and I don't necessarily, like, it's not an enjoyable film to watch because you're just, like, it's just people wandering around and whispering with, like, whatever voiceover you could use yeah. to kind of stitch the plot together. But this one, it does feel like, and maybe it's because it is, you know, a historical thing, just like The Thin Red Line was, there is an actual crux of a story here that he kind of has to go along with. And I was doing a little bit of research beforehand and looking up what the other cuts were, and apparently, you know, with the original 150-minute cut that was released, I guess, at some film festivals or with a limited theatrical run, you know, that was a lot, you know, the plot was a lot looser, and this was kind of to cut it down. And yeah, it is one of those things where sometimes studio interference, sometimes some studio notes can be a good thing. Sometimes it's like, okay, let's reel this back a little bit. We don't need this 3-hour epic. And you always hear stories, and I don't know if this is true, but like apparently when Colin Farrell was shooting this, there was a scene where he was just giving this intense monologue and he was like, wow, I really killed it. And he looks over his shoulder and like Terrence Malick is shooting like a fucking bird that's flying by or something. And that just seems like the most Malick thing I've ever heard in my life, because there is some like incredible imagery in here, but it is still, you do still get plot and character and saying like some important things about like, oh, here's what happened, like with just kind of this beautiful new world that was just kind of ruined by just like people just coming, you know, and just, you know, the kind of like end of the innocence. And I think that is something that works A, really well with Malick, but B, with Inarritu. This is his first collaboration with Chivo, and I think that pairing is so perfect. The two of them, like, I don't know if there ever has been a more perfect pairing of a cinematographer and a director, because they both are so, just have that same kind of cinematic eye of just like, oh yeah, we're just going to shoot this really beautiful nature and we're going to use a lot of natural light. Like, they've both been very famous for that in their career separately, and now I don't know how much natural light was used in this one particularly. I couldn't really find a lot of info. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, they really, I mean, they were very authentic with the set design and with lighting, and they were really, yeah, big on that, trying to use natural light whenever possible.
Okay, and that's something that, for me personally, is, like, a huge thing. Like, I love movies like Barry Lyndon and Amadeus that just use as much available or natural light as possible. And so when these guys team up, it's like, yeah, let's see it. I'm all on board. But I think that their styles lend itself really naturally to this story, more than, like, Christian Bale being at, like, a music festival or whatever, where it's right. like, oh, yeah. This right. is like this really pristine, beautiful world. And one scene that really sticks out to me with that is Colin Farrell is kind of coming back from the village, and it's the James Horner score just like swelling, and he's looking around and there's all this nature, and he just walks in and it's this just absolutely shitty fort that's like flooded and there's like starving children, and the music just cuts out completely. And it's just like, wow, that really hits you. And that the direction, the cinematography, and the score all work so perfectly right there to hit home on the themes. And I think that's what a lot of times with Malick, it's more about the kind of like vibes than the story. And here, the vibes really do support the story in a really meaningful way. Yeah.
Totally agree.
For me, it's very much an artistic film, and if you go in with that notion, you might enjoy it a little bit more. If you're looking more about like a very like story-driven movie, I mean, I think it's very much of a simplistic story of the telling of Pocahontas. I mean, you do get the nuances of the history. Of course, it's far from the original actual history, which is, you know, still hasn't really been portrayed well on screen. And so, yeah, so it is very much, I would put it as an artistic film. The scenery and the shots and the cinematography, like you said, is very much a beautiful thing. And if you're going in to appreciate that, like, you know, like going to a museum and a work of art, I think that's like what I would equate it to, is like you're essentially going to a museum and learning history with this film. But I think overall, like, there's very limited dialogue. I think it and most of the dialogue is with voiceovers. I think that of the Terrence Malick films, with this one and The Thin Red Line that I've watched, I enjoy The Thin Red Line a little bit more, because like the war aspect provides a little bit more of an action and movement to its story. I think that this one, like, I really did enjoy the acting of it. I mean, it definitely like turned the tides of which John I enjoyed more, because I grew up as a 90s kid and the original Pocahontas and stuff like that, which, of course, learning the real true history, you kind of get disenchanted by the stories of both this and that and the cartoon. But yeah, it was the acting and the way that they portrayed these characters and the complexities of these characters definitely felt very genuine, and I think that I'm very much a person of character development and story development. So when those elements came into play in this movie, that's when I enjoyed the movie a lot more. I did enjoy, like, when the movie first started and I saw Christian Bale's name in it, I was like, oh, so this is a second Pocahontas story that he was in, because he played Thomas, John Smith's friend, in the Disney animation as well.
I didn't know that.
Yes.
That's hilarious.
Yeah. So in this one, he's actually John Rowell. But yeah, it was very much enjoyable and in the story elements. And going back to like me switching which John I actually liked more for Pocahontas, you could say, in the original cartoon, it's like, oh, John Smith got hurt, so that's why he's going back to England and stuff like that. And this one, he essentially ghosts her, like literally ghosts her. Yeah. You know, says like, oh, wait 2 months, tell her I'm dead and stuff. And while it's still wasn't his choice to leave her and stuff like that, I think that the whole ghosting thing kind of put a damper on that relationship. And but I did very much enjoy John Rowell as which I, of course, not historically correct at all, but definitely enjoyed John Rowell as being like a very loving husband and very understanding of her past relationship with John Smith, and even to the point of like allowing her to like let her go if need be. And I mean, overall, like, if comparing the two men, I do like Christian Bale a little bit more, so that had some winning over for John Rowell as a character as well. But yeah, it is very much a sad telling of, you know, this historical story of Pocahontas. I think that's what it grasps well of, the sadness of the Pocahontas story is what, and how, yeah, she was kind of shunned and toted around. I mean, I think definitely they limited the amount of her being toted around as like essentially a novelty in England, which her life ended up being. But I did appreciate like the historical, you know, all of it, the clothing, specifically the historical accuracy of that. What she wore to the queen was like exactly what is depicted in history of her wearing. So that was very nice and stuff. And overall enjoyed the story when it was there, appreciated the scenery and stuff like that. I just wish that it delved more into the story and the characters. And I mean, I know that they're not complex characters to depict, but there is a lot more opportunity to explore and that complexity of that time and era in American history. And yeah, I think that very much so it captured the environment, but not the story. So yeah.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Interesting thing about that, I went and saw a screening of this in LA, and the amazing actress who played Pocahontas, Priyanka Kilcher, I think is how you say her name. She was there for a Q&A afterwards, and she was saying she was like really upset when she first saw the film, because she was like, wait, we like acted out lots of scenes with dialogue and there was like a story, and I thought we were like making X movie, but Terrence Malick doesn't work that way. He just like shoots infinite amounts of like material and then like makes a movie later, basically. So it's really interesting to think about how there's probably a bunch of different movies here. Like there maybe is a very plot focused, story driven movie that you could have assembled in the edit, but Terrence Malick being Terrence Malick kind of ends up veering towards like vibes and what does it feel like to be in this space in this time, and like I don't really care about like how they got from A to B, I'm just gonna like put you in this space. Which I think if you're an audience going into a movie expecting a normal Hollywood movie, it's like very disorienting. And I was reading about how like, you know, there's like a cinema score thing where they ask audiences for their rating as they leave a movie, and this one got a D+.
Yeah.
it was not a good cinema score. Because people like they thought they were going to see kind of like a Hollywood Pocahontas movie, and it was a Terrence Malick movie.
Which I don't need to ask. Are like
fights, you know.
I mean, I'm sure they advertised it as like, look, it's Colin Farrell, look, it's a big Hollywood blockbuster. This is not Braveheart.
Which is not something that I'm like asking for. I was just asking for, I'm fine with a slow burn and stuff like that. I just was asking for more context, but like, you know, like there could definitely be a balance that could be met between the environment and the people in that environment. And I think that that's something that could have meld a lot better and could have been added to with the characters that live in this environment. I mean, definitely a aspect of storytelling is getting the opinions and thoughts of the people that live in this environment, not just explaining the environment itself. And not very appreciative of directors that are like that. I mean, like, yes, like with Terrence Malick, but then also, you know, like with Stanley Kubrick, for example, like he awesome movies, incredible movies, but when you're not collaborating with your actors or with the crew or with, you know, things like that, the people around you, it's very much going to make like for a bad, I can only imagine like how Stanley Kubrick's like, you know, career would have carried on if, you know, he lived longer and stuff like that and continued on his work. But, and maybe that's why Terrence Malick doesn't really do many films, is because of that kind of notoriety. But yeah, I mean, I think that overall, like, that's what makes the best types of movies, is the collaboration between everybody involved in the filmmaking process. So yeah.
Sorry, I kind of wanted to hear everybody's kind of opinion on it, because this was my, I don't think I've seen a Terrence Malick film before. Oh, so welcome. I was kind of like, all right.
This is what it is.
This is more straightforward than a lot of them, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, this is like one of the most accessible.
Yeah.
All right, cool. So it was like a nice little starter pack.
Yeah. You watch some other ones and you're like, what was the dinosaurs about?
Yeah.
So I was kind of like, I went in blind, you know. When I finished it, I was kind of like, okay, where are the blue cats at? Where's the giant blue cats? You know, but it's interesting. Like, I think you guys hit a lot of the nail on the head on what kind of director he is, and it kind of gives me a lot more context, because when I finished it, I was a little like, oh, okay, that was that, and it's a very gorgeous film, and I think with a little more context, it makes a little more sense of what it is. Like, I did kind of do a little research and saw the cinema score thing as well, where I was like, oh, wow, okay. And have you seen, Alex, like the other cuts by any chance?
I have, yeah. I've seen the other two cuts each like once. And I think, yeah, the reason why I was like, guys, watch the theatrical cut is because the other two cuts do feel more like Terrence Malick's other work to me, where it's his uncut vision, where there's long stretches of story that do just descend into kind of like unconnected poetry. And you know, that's here too in this cut, but at least like events that happen semi-regularly, there are like something happens like within a reasonable amount of time in this movie, whereas in like the 172 minute cut there are periods where you just kind of go into like a daze and you're like, I don't really know where we are anymore or what is moving forward. You know, this movie I think has a second act slump, as a lot of movies do, but especially for like an already slow movie after John Smith ghosts Pocahontas. You know, in the way a lot of biopics feel sometimes, where it's like life just keeps going on for somebody, even though it's not like on a dramatic trajectory. There is that kind of like just period of depression for Pocahontas, where she's kind of just moping about and just generally a sad person. And that's where, yeah, Christian Bale comes in. And then I think the movie becomes interesting to me once they travel to England. And there's just this reverse experience of somebody from the new world seeing the old, you know, seeing the modern world, basically. Mm-hmm. And then the finale always really moves me because it feels like the spirit of this person was broken for this kind of good chunk of the movie. She was kind of taken in from this Edenic existence, put in a corset, put in high heels, kind of made to live in this other life that is like not bringing her alive. And the final images of her, you know, as we learn that she's died really young, are her like in that corset, in that dress, but back to the free spirit, back to the aliveness we saw at the beginning of the movie. And so I think the movie, in that kind of non-literal, not plot-driven way, to me, the core of it is just really about this woman who goes from being at one with her environment, fully alive, kind of fully untainted by like this modern world coming in, being kind of broken by it and broken by the, you know, the totally fictionalized romantic story. And then at the end, kind of finding herself again or reconnecting to that like aliveness again. And so for me, the movie is really about those kinds of things that aren't even like really plot based, but are kind of emotion and vibe based. And that's why the overall arc of the movie, even if at parts I'm like, where is this going? Why are we here? Ultimately, like very much moves me because it's about this like foundational clash of like essentially like completely different cultures clashing into each other. And this one individual who is like taken from one to the other. And so, yeah, just as far as Malick movies go, that's more going on than in a lot of Malick movies. And so that's what makes this my favorite of his, because if I'm going to go on a tone poem journey, there's at least all this other stuff going on that is very interesting to me.
So like the purpose of the film was to be a lot more, because I get what you guys are saying now, like in a poetic instance, because it's, you know, there's a lot of melancholy towards it, and there's beauty in the nature. And I do like how he kind of shifts between the beauty of nature of like Pocahontas's world, and then you see like John Smith's world of it's like cloudy and gray and just depressing and everything. And I kind of do like that they both characters kind of got to experience both lives, I guess, you know. And it's sad that Pocahontas had a go that route of having experienced like the gray, but there's also the modern. And you know, I always like seeing films where they have like the person out of time, where they just, you know, like Back to the Future, you know, Marty's walking around, he's seeing like the 50s, or he's in the far off year of 2015 and seeing all these things. And I kind of like seeing that with Pocahontas, because all I know is the Disney Pocahontas. I'm that's all I really knew about it. So when I went to this, I was like, oh, cool, there's a little bit more. And there's more to the story. And yeah, it's a very, I guess, vibe-ish film, like you guys are saying. It's very, the imagery is what kind of gets you compared to the story and the acting. There's even times where I was just very excited that there are certain actors, like Ben Mendelsohn was in it. You know, Christian Bale. Christian Bale doesn't show up to like the almost hour and 40 minute mark.
Last third of the movie, yeah.
Yeah, and I was like, whoa,
it's funny because I was like, wait, isn't Christian Bale in this? And like immediately, like, I was thinking that when there was the stockades, and like as soon as I thought it, he showed up. I was like, oh, right, okay, there he is.
And yeah, where was Ben Mendelsohn? I was like looking for him the whole
time.
He's
just one of the dudes who's like looking really gaunt and kind of sad in the settlement. There's one scene, I think, where he's just kind of like just hungry or something. And he's just staring at John Smith like through his window. Then they're very vibey scene. But it's like during a montage of just like, you know, they're starving during the winter. They're like eating their belts because they have no like protein.
Yeah.
I mean, it's. That what I appreciate about the movie is that even though the, you know, the personal stories I think are highly fictionalized, the romance, and Malick is using these characters of John Smith and John Rolfe to kind of just tell, I think, maybe a more timeless story about like first love and then like more mature love, because you've got this first love overwhelming excitement of the John Smith story, but once she sees him later in life and kind of sees him clearly, he suddenly doesn't look so appealing. He kind of is sad. He's kind of like lame in the way that he's like crawling back to her after ghosting her. And you can see Pocahontas go from the transformation of like, there's that first love feeling, and then there's the kind of like the person you marry, you know, the John Rolfe. I don't think that was actually her experience of those two men at all in real life, but they're using the historical thing to tell that timeless story of like two kinds of love. What I was saying before I veered off into that was I like how historically accurate everything else is, you know, around that love story. Because and when I was reading about the movie, I mean, they did a lot of research, and a lot of the things that are said in voiceover about the, you know, John Smith's observations of Pocahontas or the Powhatan tribe, and those are literal like journal quotes, not necessarily from John Smith, but from settlers at the time about their observations of the natives. And there's lots of paintings that are directly referenced in the imagery. And so I really love how authentic it is, including just how god awful it was for the people who came there to settle America and had no idea what they were doing, did not know how to live off the land, did everything wrong. We're digging for gold instead of like finding food. Just like, what a miserable, miserable bunch of guys. Like, totally awful. And then the movie does not shy away from showing just how grotesque and awful those early settlements were.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Ariel, were you gonna mention something? Sorry, I think I might have cut you off.
No, just that, like, yeah, like going off of depicting, yeah, like I was just like so like how these people just sucked at surviving. I mean yeah, like Colin Farrell comes in and he's like, yeah, like, guys, you build a freaking well, like, what the hell are you been doing all this time that I've been gone? Like, you know, like, they expect to plant their own, the seeds from their own lands into this land that's definitely not fertile for that kind of crop and stuff like that. But even then, like, they just like many settlers and people of that age and culture, you know, kind of like gave up very easily and just very self-involved and thinking of their own, non-collaborative at all. Because yeah, like, and then I did enjoy how they depicted, like, yeah, like the you know, natives essentially were the only thing that were keeping them alive, which is like very true. But then also showing their very hard-headedness and just not even learning. I was even thinking, like, John Smith definitely should have just tried to negotiate a way to like have these, there was only a few other people, like, just have them join, you know, the Indians, which is something that possibly happened to the Roanoke settlers as well. But yeah, just like kind of like getting them to like be absorbed into the tribe and stuff like that would have definitely like allowed them to have a little bit more survival and would have probably bettered relationships when the ships came back as well. But yeah, settlers of that time were not smart at all, even though they thought they were smart. I mean, I'm sure that they sent... Yeah, they sent them there because you guys send your stupidest people to explore.
Well, that's one of the things that I love about the movie too, is that there's a confrontation scene, you know, and it shows how, like, you know, there's no law and order. Mm-hmm. So like whoever like shouts the loudest like shoots somebody else and gets the badge that says I'm the king of the Jamestown. Mm-hmm. And I love during one of those confrontations, they start accusing each other, like, hey, no, you're actually a criminal. You're actually somebody who was, like, outcast. Like, you're not actually you're not a lord. You lied about that. You're, like, a peasant. So it just shows how, like, most of the people who are coming to America are, like, not the best people, you know? Like, England's not sending their best. And, like, it's the people who are literally, like, outcast and, like, don't belong in, like, like the rest of their like society. So those are probably not going to be the best like leaders or the most resourceful like people you want to like be living with. And I think the movie is just really honest about that, which I love.
Yeah. Mm.
It always amazes me that the England were the ones that like kind of establish things, whereas like, you know, the Spaniards played smart, sent their best, sent their explorers, their scholars and stuff like that. Portugal as well. Like all these other countries send their best. Vikings, you know, sent their best. But yeah, I think it's just their stubbornness just kept them here.
And the Christopher Plummer character, I think does a really good job.
He was the smartest one, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, he's like the only real leader amongst them.
Yeah.
But he does a good job of, you know, he's kind of almost like a preacher when he talks to them about how, like, there's that manifest destiny sense of, no, this is like, we are destined to find the Indies on the other side of this continent. We are destined to cross to the new world or whatever. So there's definitely a sense of like almost religious destiny driving them that is, you know, can make even like a bunch of losers just keep trying over and over again.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing is like he left and like, of course, everything falls apart. Cause yeah, like he comes in and says like, don't mess with the natives, try to get on their best interests. We're not here to settle. We're not here to like conquer. We're here to just like find a way to the West Indies, which they, you know, of course doesn't exist. And because they didn't know where they landed. But yeah, like it's very much so like I'm sure that things would have gone a lot better if he stood. So did he just go back to England and then came back?
If my understanding is. It's hard to follow on a first viewing for sure. Like I've seen the movie a few times to even like know what the hell is going on half the time. But you know, if you watch it enough times, you catch the dialogue that is kind of not really buried. It's not put front and center. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's almost like if you catch it, you catch it, but maybe you won't. But if you do catch the dialogue, essentially, you know, they half their food rations are like full of worms and like gone bad. And they're basically, they need like reinforcements, they need like a shipment of new supplies, they need more people, and so Christopher Plummer's character goes back to England to like get help basically and bring them back, but they can't cross over until after winter, so he basically leaves these poor survivors to try to make it through the winter while he goes and gets like the cavalry. And there is that moment in the movie where the Powhatan Native Americans, you know, attack them and they're kind of at war, but that ends when Christopher Plummer's kind of fleet comes back and they're shooting off their cannons, and basically at that point the domination of the natives begins.
Yeah. I just wanted to circle back to a couple things you guys were talking about. Real fast, I want to correct myself earlier. I said completely the wrong name. I think Inuratu, I meant to say Emmanuel Lubezki.
Who also works with Emmanuel Lubezki, so I understand
why. I think that's what threw me off. You know, Chivo, as he's referred to. But I just wanted to, you were talking about, Alex, how authentic this is, and that really goes beyond a lot of even, like, you know, just like the diaries and stuff. Like, they had the actors in this reconstruct a completely dead language, or a mostly dead language, and kind of speak that, and, like, just kind of recreate painstakingly this culture, you know. So I thought I really appreciated that, which is in stark contrast to the kind of, you know, Disneyfication that we see, you know, in another Pocahontas story. And I felt like they did a really good job treating these characters with respect, especially, you know, the Pocahontas character. And we briefly kind of touched on how you know, era you mentioned, oh, she did kind of get paraded around England and stuff like that. And I thought they did a really good job of showing that when she goes to meet the king, who it's another, just sidebar, it's another Terrence Malick thing where it's like, oh, that's a huge actor. They have zero lines because he probably got everything cut. Like, you're like, the king is Jonathan Pryce. You're like, okay.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
But she's there, and you see also all these, like, quote-unquote exotic animals in cages, mm-hmm. like a raccoon and stuff like that. And it's like, okay, yeah, I get the visual thing that you're doing
here.
You got
to see her friend again.
Yeah, Miko.
It's the
raccoon, look at that. Oh, well.
And I love that moment because, first of all, you have the bald eagle symbol of America that's, like, chained, and, like, they're, like, laughing and clapping as it, like, tries to escape, you know, the British, you know, the fun little visual symbol there. And then I really love the performance when Pocahontas, like, kneels next to the kind of just, like, sad raccoon that's just, like, laid down and just, like, given up.
Yeah.
And she's, like, you can tell that she, like, feels the same. Like, she's also a raccoon in a cage who is just here to be an amusement for the British.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And I think that really hits on, Terrence Malick is somebody who I think your mileage really varies on him. And I think, you know, I get it why, like, people like Ariel, it might not hit for you. For me, I'm a really big Malick fan. Like, I love Tree of Life. I think it's a masterpiece, but I get why people, they do not vibe with it. For me, like, if this was more kind of plot heavy, it wouldn't really be a Malick movie. It would probably be more like, I don't know, like, oh my gosh, Richard Linklater movie, you know, who is obviously his protege, but he is much more kind of a down the line, straightforward guy. Like, he still does, you know, some weird stuff, but he's much more story driven.
Like a Ridley Scott movie, a Ridley Scott historical epic. You know, I could see him absolutely doing a great Ridley Scott movie about this historical period and the conflicts, but it wouldn't be like this. It would be very different.
Mm-hmm. So I think it really comes down to personal taste, honestly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, for me, I'm very much like, I feel like the person themselves are a lot more. I feel like the person itself is a lot more of an importance than the environment were, and it shows a lot more craftsmanship, or different type of craftsmanship, I guess you can say, of actually knowing people, and it shows like a nuance of like knowing and being personalized and understanding the person if it's more dialogue heavy and character driven. Whereas, you know, it's just a different type of art, mm-hmm. I guess you can say, that of just like understanding the environment more. You know, it's two different personalities, I guess you can say, of filmmaking.
There's an immersive quality to this, I think, that's almost more like it's like a full body experience. It's like, it's a good movie to watch with like headphones because the sound mix is really good, like the nature sounds. So I feel like it's almost like a simulation. It's like, we're going to place you in these settings, envelop you in the sounds, take our time with like the scenery. So it's almost like it's less about the story and more about the experience, which depending on what you want from a movie can be frustrating.
Yeah. I'm not frustrated. Like, I have an understanding of it, and it is, definitely. It's something that you have to be in the mood for of like, okay, I'm just going to essentially go into a symposium or, you know, the equivalent of like a symposium or, you know, an exhibit and experience like what it was like in that time period. And that's what this movie kind of represents of that, of like, okay, understanding like the surroundings and what it was like to live in this time and space. This movie very much provides for that. But for a story standpoint, doesn't have much leg on to stand on for that part. Yeah.
You getcha. Totally. Yeah, I mean, I feel you on that. I think too, my thing is like, I enjoyed it, and it's not really like something I'll go back on, to be honest. Mm-hmm. But it is definitely an experience where it did feel dreamlike. Like, I appreciated... Mm-hmm. Like you said, Alex, it does feel immersive. And like, I think too, because I had all the windows closed and it was very quiet. The whole apartment's really quiet right now. So watching it was very like dreamlike. And then there's that instance where even Colin Farrell's like, was that a dream? And I'm like, well, was that a dream? And yeah, right. I do get it. I do understand the whole, like, you got to kind of rewatch it, because there was times where I was like, wait, what? Like, I kind of caught myself having to rewind and be like, wait, what just happened? Or, and then there was a point where I was like, just enjoy it. Just sit in it.
Yeah, you gotta let it wash over you. Because the editing is also can be quite disorienting. There's scenes where there's like jump cuts that you don't expect, where it's like you thought you were kind of going into like a dialogue scene, but now we're already at the end of it, and like they've already moved on to something else, and now, or we're in a different space and time. Like, how did we get here? I thought we were over here. And it really does have almost like a dream logic. Like, it does mostly flow forward in time and does have a progression, but it also can feel non-linear and has almost like a David Lynch vibe in that like non-linearity and the dreamlike quality of it.
Yeah. So, and I think, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, Alex.
No, you go.
No, I was just going to say, for me, like I was kind of alluding to before, if something is like way too much that direction, it can really take me out of the movie. If like that's all the movie is doing is just trying to be like, hey, this is something that looks cool, just live in this world for a little bit. I do need a little bit more than that. But if something is like, okay, here's just like a by the books textbook story, that might be not my favorite either. And for me personally, this really hits the sweet spot of we're going to give you a little bit of both worlds. It's not going to be too surreal, but it is going to be kind of just ethereal enough that you're gonna want to like live in this world for 2 hours, maybe not 3 hours, maybe not the 170 minute cut, but like I think you absolutely picked the right cut for this. And that's something I maybe wanted to go into a little bit of. There is always debates on movies of like, oh, should you watch this version, should you watch this version? And you know, that's becoming more and more of a thing now that we are getting so many avenues for just like alternative versions to come out. I remember like I was just looking at Peacock the other day and they're like, oh, here's the new extended cut of Jurassic World Dominion. I'm like, is there any chance that that makes that movie better at all? Like, or is it just more stuff, you know? And I think there are, you know, a few different kinds of cuts. There's usually, you know, you want to see like
Batman people talk Superman about Ultimate Edition.
I actually do think that improved the movie quite a bit, honestly. but yeah, there are the cuts where it's like, okay, there's clearly stuff in this story that needed to be put back in that the studio took out. And then there's stuff like, okay, like I like, you know, the Lord of the Rings movies was like, these movies are complete movies. It's cool to have more in it. And there's stuff where it's like, we don't really need this. We don't need this extra stuff. So I don't know if you guys wanted to talk about just kind of like director's cuts, quote unquote, director's cuts in general. Another one I recently watched, the director's cut of Alien, which is shorter, even though there's more scenes in it, because Ridley Scott just cuts the beginning, that like 7 minute just shot of the ship going. He just cuts off 4 minutes off and then he puts in some extra stuff. So I don't know. I always find director's cuts and or whatever kind of cuts they might call them, the Richard Donner Superman 2, you know, is interesting and iconic. So I don't know if you guys had any thoughts on that in general.
I think we've mentioned this before on like other instances where we've had this kind of conversation, but I think it just very much depends on if the content or the cut of content contributes to the overall story and its completeness. I mean, definitely like if like, for example, yeah, if that Dominion cut provides a lot more story, that it provides a bit more of a complete understanding, because yeah, like that movie was it's very much a disconjunction of a movie at times, so maybe that extra additional footage kind of like adds more context to kind of make a lot more complete story. I mean, definitely Blade Runner, which we, you know, had discussed on my podcast of You Never Seen, of the different versions of that, and essentially the most definitive one being, I think, the final cut. And that's because of like, it's just how it flows, how the story, like it cuts out like the fat that's not needed, but then also keeps and adds things that provide more story and more context And yeah, like it just depends on how it contributes to the story in the movie itself. If it's in a positive way, then yeah, sure, add it in. The most recent cut of that fun cut was Spider-Man 1 that I just recently saw. And yeah, there's some things in there that like is really nice. It doesn't contribute to the story, but it's really nice to see. You kind of have an understanding of why that things are cut, but at the same time, like an extra like 2 minutes of seeing Matt Murdock, yeah, I'll take that. So yeah, it just depends on if it and that, yeah, it just depends on the situation and what it contributes to the story. If it's just little things that you add and doesn't really contribute, but it's for a fun way, then that's acceptable in my opinion too. But as long as it doesn't convolute the story and the movie, I think is what's key. Finding that balance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for me, it's kind of like if you're already a fan of a movie and just want like deleted scenes and like want more and want to see it in context with the rest of the film, then like why not? But mm-hmm. I would say as like a definitive version of a movie, you know, The Lord of the Rings is an interesting example because I think there are some scenes that probably should be additional cut, especially when I think about Two Towers. There's that big flashback that reveals Faramir's motivations, Boromir's brother, like why he even is doing anything in Two Towers, why he cares about the ring and about getting it and bringing it to his father. I kind of need an information to know why this story is even happening, and that's only in the extended cut. There's other scenes in the extended cut of Two Towers that involve like hijinks with Merry and Pippin and like Treebeard that like don't really need to be there. So it's, I think there are sometimes, like you're saying, Ariel, there's scenes that it's like, oh man, I wish that was in the theatrical cut because it would have actually improved the story itself. And then there's like the fact that like I'm an editor and I can see that like, yeah, you obviously don't need this for anything else in this movie. It's not progressing the characters, not progressing the story. It's just like another scene that you could or could not have. And those should pretty much always be cut, in my opinion, because we want to be carried through this story and not just like lingering in these like sidetrack kind of unrelated scenes. So yeah, with a movie like this, like with The New World, yeah, I the reason I was so adamant that we all watch the theatrical cut is that it's an example of, for me, less is more. Like this movie becomes not one of my favorite movies when there is more of it. Like, I actually prefer less of it because the balance that you were talking about, Derek, like, isn't there in the other cuts. And that balance of and just enough character, just enough story to, like, hold on to, but still the beauty and the poetry, that is what makes this movie special to me. And when that goes out of balance and now just becomes a beautiful movie, but not something I necessarily want to watch over and over again. It's different cuts are different for different movies. Cause yeah, Blade Runner is another interesting example where it's like, you definitely don't want the studio cut of Blade Runner. That is not the best marriage of director and studio.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it really depends.
Yeah. Yeah. Alan, I will go with you on that. Especially the Snyder Cut and the Batman v Superman cut, the extended cut, are a lot better for that reason as well. But you could go on and just talk about the specifics of that.
Yeah, no, I can go for days for BVS and Snyder Cut. But no, I kind of wanted to talk about like that process that you were saying where it just doesn't fit. Like how Derek was actually mentioning Saw Alien. I actually saw Aliens, the extended cut, and yeah, I was like, it really slows the movie down, especially since Aliens kind of jumps, like kind of changes the genre a little bit, where Alien is a lot more suspenseful horror, and then Aliens is sci-fi action kind of thing. And like Aliens Extended just gets very slow and moody, and you're kind of like, okay, like it seems like it was trying to do what Ridley Scott did in Alien, and then James Cameron's trying to do his own thing, and yet it doesn't mesh well. Like, I can totally see why, like, some movies need to be edited and cut the way they are. And BVS and Snyder Cut are fucking awesome because it adds more to those stories and everything. But, yeah, I kind of wanted to add on a little bit actually ask another question. What type of films have you guys seen that kind of are reminiscent to this? or do you feel directors have been influenced by Terrence Malick? Because one of the biggest vibes I got from this was, I was like, whoa, I feel like Robert Eggers probably is a fan, because I felt a lot of that vibe thing that you guys were talking about in The Witch and The Lighthouse, especially The Lighthouse, because that whole movie is like very specific, like vibes and tone and set and everything. And The Witch kind of had something similar in that aspect. But yeah, I felt a lot of like, I was like, okay, maybe he got influence from Terrence Malick. But yeah, so what films do you guys kind of see that in?
Yeah, I would agree with you with Robert Eggers. I think Robert Eggers finds my balance, my preferred balance between these two worlds. I mean, The Lighthouse is just an amazing environment and story, but then it's also, and it might have been made a little bit more easy with two characters, but you definitely get a sense of these two characters, like in The Lighthouse, and it is like that. I, in my opinion, that's the well balance between environment and surroundings and character and how they interact as well. I mean, like with The Lighthouse, it is definitely like seeing the influence of this lighthouse and on these people, and then their influence on this surrounding as well. I haven't yet seen The Northman yet, but I do feel like I need to watch
really
it. I'm hoping. That's something I need to watch. But that one even feels like there's that environment, that culture. I think it comes down to like that he's very well good at capturing, like he's very well good at capturing culture and personality of that time, you can say. And I think that Robert Eggers like definitely knocks out of the park and finds that perfect balance between those two worlds.
And he's just the same way Terrence Malick was with the historical like rigor of like, Robert Eggers is obsessed with like every detail of a time and capturing these weird eccentricities of a time. And another director I was thinking about that was influenced by Malick, I'm sure, is Ari Aster. If you look at, Midsommar.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Midsommar feels very Malick-y in a lot of ways. And Midsommar is one of my favorite movies of the last few years. And
yes.
These are all A24 directors, but also Trey Edward Schultz, who did It Comes at Night and Waves. They feel very Malick to me. Barry Jenkins, even. I think there's a lot of filmmakers that I think are inspired by the cinematic poetry that Malick really is known for and has been doing for so many years.
Yeah, maybe that's why I was a bit disappointed with this one, because I've had experience a lot more with those kind of directors and stories and how I'd say the evolution, like I guess experiencing the next evolution of this type of storytelling and then kind of going back to the further
the origin,
the building blocks, to the origins or the previous generation. Yeah. That might've contributed to my opinions on this, on the new world.
Yeah, it's kind of like almost like a classical music. I mean, there's literally classical music, but it's like this is the classical music version of all of it, and these guys are doing like a remix. They're like, they're taking the classical music but also making it edgier, and I love these directors, because they are taking these inspirations but also making them feel modern and have a lot of oomph to them.
And I mentioned obviously Linklater, who is a protege of his, but I think to throw another A24 guy onto the list, I would say definitely David Lowery. I think is someone who is very influenced by him, especially like anybody out there who's seen A Ghost Story. Like that feels very much in that same kind of vibe. Even something like that's relatively straightforward, like Pete's Dragon is, which is one of the first films we ever covered on the show, is very much that. That beautiful cinematography, kind of like living in this world and just kind of being struck by the kind of majesty and the beauty of the natural world. So he's one of my favorite directors. He's basically the only person that I could get excited for a Peter Pan Disney live-action remake to be happening. So yeah, definitely him. And, you know, spoiler, we're going to be actually talking about one of Lowry's more recent films in an episode coming up for anybody who's listening, so stay tuned for that.
One other thing I'll say about a lot of these directors, you know, Robert Eggers and Lowry, I think, like Malick, they're really good at capturing almost like a mental state in their movies. Like, you feel like you're going crazy in Midsommar. Like, you feel like you're on the psychedelics and, like, reality is coming apart. And I think there's almost, in the New World, you feel the slowness of time in this, like, distant era where, like, nobody has clocks, nobody knows what day of the week it is. Like, you're like living in the rhythms and at the pace of nature, and the movie, I think, respects that rhythm and pace and puts you in that mindset. It's very, very meditative, almost like, you know, they say like forest bathing is good for you, just going and like walking and hiking in the forest. I feel like this movie is like forest bathing the movie. I think it's just, I really like directors that are able to, like, through the tools of cinema, capture like a headspace and like and put you in it. And this is like a very peaceful nature headspace. Whereas, yeah, these other directors are taking some more extreme headspaces, like going crazy in a lighthouse or being drugged at a Nordic cult festival.
Yeah. Or feeling like you're watching your widow just become, you know, you're a ghost for 100 years watching your widow live, and then your house becomes an apartment building.
I need to see A Ghost Story. I haven't seen that one.
Oh, sorry for the spoiling, but yeah.
That's a spoiler movie, yeah.
It's one of those movies you watch and you, like, can't decide for a week whether or not you liked it. You're like, was that good? Was that genius, or was that just weird? Like,
but is that a good thing to do? That comes down to another story of, like, is it good to have your audience second guess if they like it or not? Or is it... I'm all for making a thoughtful movie and thinking about it and stuff like that, but I think in a way it should be more so of, like, questioning the understanding of the movie. Overall, you enjoy it, but you come out questioning the actual story, but to question if you like it or not. And I think that that's something that a lot of, like, movies and artur directors have kind of, like, tried to strive. I don't know if they're trying to strive for it, but there's a nuance of that in modern day films, like this kind of thing. And I don't really enjoy it as an audience member. I mean, I don't really enjoy coming out of a movie. Did I like that movie? Did I not like that movie? There's the opportunity of, like, okay, create another rewatchability to it. And I think it just harms the movie, in my opinion, if I come out of the theater thinking that. Is it a good movie? Is it not a good movie? And I don't know.
I feel like, for me, there are movies that feel like they hate their audience. That, like kind of, like, actively don't like you and are gonna, like, punish you or make you suffer, and like, say that's good and, like, that's art. And those movies generally upset me, where it feels like there's nothing to hold on to here for me to, like, love. This is more a movie to be, like, punished by or, like, suffered through and told that, like, good for you. You ate your vegetables and suffered through this movie. And those movies do upset me, because it does feel like, who's this movie for? Is this movie for an audience, or is this for you, the director, to just feel like you, like, did a thing, but it wasn't really for anybody? I do like movies that maybe I don't know if I like love or, like, even liked a ton on the first viewing, but there was something about it that sticks with me. That was beautiful in the cinematography or the editing or the music, that, like, does make me want to return to it.
If I have a desire to return to it,
and then it on a second and third viewing comes more, like, it opens up to me and I realize, oh wow, this is actually a great movie. I miss these things in the first viewing. That I really like that experience. So I think yeah, if the movie gives me a reason to come back and doesn't like hate me, then
yeah.
then I love the experience of going back to a movie that I'm not sure about and realizing, oh, wait a minute, this is like a masterpiece, and I just like didn't get it the first time around.
Yeah, yeah. I'm very much understanding of,
well,
of
can
like,
I real fast when... answer your question? Because I completely agree that, like, yeah, when I do, I don't want to feel like every movie to me, like, have to think about it for a week, like, oh, did I like that or not? But I do like when something different comes along and makes me kind of, like, question what was that. Because usually when I'm thinking about did I like a movie, did I not like a movie, most of the time I will end up on, like, just by the process of me thinking about what is causing me to like question this, I will usually land on yes, I did like it. Not all the time, but a lot of the time. Whereas when I'm watching a movie and it is weird and does all these things, like for example, yesterday I watched Blonde and I was halfway through that movie and I was like, I do not like this movie. Like, there's very few movies that I'm just like, no, this movie has no redeeming qualities, and Blonde is that movie. It is bad from an artistic standpoint, it is bad from just like its storytelling, it's weirdly just like its politics are really fucked. But, like, but, you know, when a movie can be weird and make me think about it a lot, and then I have to, like, sit in it, I do like that feeling, and then usually I will kind of come around. So I do think it's not necessarily a good or bad thing, but it right. definitely can be good.
Yeah. No, I'm all for, like, thinking about a movie. But to have the notion of, like, do I not like this movie? It is like a negative connotation that I wouldn't want it personally if I were to make a movie to invoke on my audience.
Versus neutrality.
Neutrality is all okay. Like, it's like, I think I need to investigate this more is a okay thing for you to like have in a movie. Because yes, like it, especially if you're creating like a complex emotion to be felt with to your audience, then that's okay, because then yeah, like it's complex, I understand, like you could come back and think about it more, you know. But it to be like, is it bad or is it not bad, that's the thing, is like that shouldn't be in the mind in your audience, I think what yeah. I'm saying
to clarify, I never thought A Ghost Story was bad, it was more like, did this work for me?
I'm just talking about the notion. Yeah. I've never seen A Ghost Story either. But yeah, I'm just talking about that notion of the role of a director and a writer. So of like, you
what's
know,
their job?
You, yeah, what yeah. is their job? And like, I know the understand, like, you know, doing it for yourself and stuff like that, but you enter into like this art form. That it's not, when you put it out, it's not just going to be yours anymore. It's going to be other people's. And do you want to you want to be seen or felt less like the natural human nature. And so that's what it should act on. Is like, I'm showing you who I, or like if it's a personal story, I'm showing you who I am. And like, this is it and stuff like that kind of thing. Like, but let's have a conversation. I think that's what movies should be, you know, kind of thing. So yeah,
I get what you mean. I feel like there's three, you guys kind of reminded me of three examples of where I kind of went through that, where I thought about it and I was like, do I like it? Like Antichrist is kind of a movie that punishes the viewer. Very much. I'm sorry,
I was saying exactly that's exactly what I was thinking about when I'm like, what movies kind of like hate their audience?
Yeah. That one really hates the audience. And then there's where I kind of walked out of it and I was like, did I like that? Was The Witch. Because I kind of had a, you know, I blame the advertising because they were really like, this is the scariest movie since The Exorcist kind of thing. And you watch it and you're kind of like, oh, this is more of a drama with like spooky stuff. And that one kind of, yeah, like it kind of left that notion. And then there's Primer, which goes out of its way to be so... doesn't care what the audience knows anything about science, time travel, anything like that. And that one, when I finished it, I was like, did I like it? And then I go, yeah, I actually really did, because I appreciated what the directors and the writers were trying to do. Like, in that weird sense of them trying to just, you know, they're saying all this sciencey stuff in it, And I'm kind of like, I don't know what the fuck you're talking about, but you're so, they made it so immersive in that sense where you kind of go, damn, I like that. I didn't understand a lot, but it provided like that sense of like, okay, I saw something. Whereas Antichrist just wants to punish you. Like it fucking doesn't care. Like it, you know, was that Lars von Trier, I think?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah, Jesus. Yeah, like that one. Yeah, so I guess it really is, I mean, film, music, art, they're all subjective, so I guess, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm happy at it least all with exists. That one,
yeah,
I'm happy exactly. It's all
yeah.
out there.
Yeah.
But at least
yeah.
with, like, the one that, like, wants to punish you, it's like, you have a mutual understanding, like, I hate you. I hate you. It's like that meme of like, what's your name? Tony. Fuck you, Tony. What's your name? Like, and they're like, fuck you and stuff. So it's kind of like that. Like, and you could like, at least we're on the same page. Like, you hate me. I hate you. Okay. Kind of thing. But yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, guys, before we wrap up here, any final thoughts on The New World before we kind of end here?
Visually beautiful.
Yeah, really beautiful. It's yeah. I am a big nature lover. I love hiking. I love going out into nature. So it is just great to see this kind of cinematography and this kind of setting just like just shot so evocatively. There's so many shots in this movie that you just frame as like wall art. So that's just always Malick in general is always going to give you that. And this is also, I think, before he and Chivo went for their like obsession with like incredibly wide angle lenses, like ultra wide lenses where everybody looks like they're kind of in like a fisheye lens bubble. This is still shot very classically in a way that I really like. So once again, in the Malick filmography, some of his later films, I think, get a little more extreme in the way that things are shot. And this is just like a classic film beauty that I really appreciate. And one thing I don't think I mentioned earlier is that I think there's also just, upon rewatch, it's a movie that really understands how to portray like different worldviews. And what I mean by that is you've got this native culture that is completely living kind of in the present, in harmony with their environment, understands like the cycles of nature, how to use nature, how to just be with it, and they're just in touch with reality. And then you've got this kind of Western modern mind that is like really obsessed with symbols. So like gold is a symbol, like gold, you can't eat gold, you can't do anything with it, but it's like, we're here for gold because it's a symbol of wealth and I want to be wealthy. And, you know, even Pocahontas is being kind of Westernized in the latter half of the movie. She's being taught to read and they're showing her all these letters and symbols. And she's like, why does the earth have colors? Like, what is a day? Like, what are you talking about? Like you're putting all these names on things that I don't think even need names because I'm just like in touch with reality in the present moment. And you're all obsessed with symbols that don't know how to like grow food. I just think it's a really cool movie that like really understands that about the two cultures. Like they're just living in different universes with their own heads, which is really interesting to see visualized in a movie.
And definitely shows like the real end of one of those worldviews and cultures. Like it just is kind of like, yeah, this is
wiping away of it. Yeah,
this is something that just, you know, does not exist anymore, sadly, or if, you know, it does, it's just kind of very small pockets and shunned away. And yeah, it's really just, yeah, like you said, tragic. And I think that his whole style lends itself to that kind of just the sad end of a way of life.
Right. And I think it's nice that the movie also isn't too like, doesn't feel like it's super in your face about it either, because
it's, you know, not preachy.
It just shows things kind of matter of factly. Like it's just matter of factly what it is, including the wonder that Pocahontas has at the modern world. When she goes to England, like it is amazing to her to look at a giant cathedral, and there are wonders that were created by this other culture. But because of the way colonization works, it's going to be at the expense of her culture ultimately.
Yeah. Well, thank you, everybody. I think that was a really good discussion on the film. But if you want to hear more of Alex, where can people hear you and see you?
Yeah, you can listen and or see me and the rest of my team at Beyond the Screenplay. You can find us on YouTube. We're also on all the podcast apps. We come out with episodes every couple weeks. We have some special bonus episodes for Patreon supporters. But yeah, we're about to do some fun kind of spooky movies for October. So I'm looking forward to that. And that's probably the main place you can find me. It's just Beyond the Screenplay. Just Google it and we're on all the different platforms.
Yep. However you're hearing us, definitely listen to them too. We have been underrated for the Undercast company. We have a couple other podcasts we do. Ariel, you have your podcast You've Never Seen, where you introduce someone to a movie they've never seen, or vice versa. I know you guys just covered The Thing, you and Alan, so I haven't got a chance to listen to that episode yet, but I'm very excited to, and everybody should check that out.
You're going to hate the last few minutes, but okay. I won't give it away.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Okay. But yeah, then I also do my podcast, Infinity Stones and Dragon Bones, talking about MCU stuff whenever there's a new MCU property that comes out. So that one's kind of more sporadic. And then coming back soon is I'm just finishing editing up and doing everything with that in my season 2 of Gateway Episodes, which is a TV podcast about getting into specific TV shows. But yeah, you can email us if you have a suggestion for an underrated movie or have any questions or want to talk to us at undercastcompany@gmail.com or undercastcompany on Instagram, Facebook, all the places, Twitter. If you guys want to reach out to us, we love hearing from you guys. We also have a Patreon and a Discord as well. So come find us there in all the places. After you've listened to Alex and Lessons from the Screenplay and Beyond the Screenplay, and all that good stuff, as well as our past guest, Trisha, who is involved with those. So, once again, man, thank you so much for being on. This was a great movie to suggest, and I had a really fun time talking about it.
I appreciated having a place to spew all my thoughts on this movie, because we haven't talked about it on our podcast, and I really wanted to talk about it. So, I appreciate giving me the space to go on and on about one of my favorite movies.
My pleasure.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for being on. We really appreciate it.